You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. You have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your bed. Horse amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome guest. This weekend, thousands of communities in all 50 states held events to educate the public on global warming issues and to mobilize the political will to make the social changes this crisis requires. This is my contribution to that effort. I'm Lynn Gary, and this is Unwelcome Guests.
The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot, and whether pigs have wings. Mother Earth is under the weather.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. First, I want to hit a couple of the highlights from last week's new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. This is the second working group looking at the impacts we are already feeling from global warming and predicting who gets hurt in the future. That turns out to be up to 30% of all species going extinct, including coral reefs, and billions of humans running out of food and water. I won't try to duplicate the whole report. You can find lots in the newspapers and on Google News. What they don't cover so well is the censorship and just plain government bumbling that watered down the results of thousands of scientific studies. The scientists spend 5 years gathering 29,000 data sets, analyzing them all, and then in the last 4 days, a slew of government bureaucrats arrived to dump important results in all-night sessions of wrangling by representatives from big polluters like the United States and China. It's criminal, really, what happens to the science. Do we need a whole new system to watch over the progress of climate change and human-induced catastrophe? We'll hear from one man with a new idea. First, let's hear a couple of minutes from the official press conference from the co-chair of Working Group 2, Martin Perry.
This report is called Climate Change Impacts, Vulnerability, and Adaptation. Climate Change 2007. It's the second of three reports by the IPCC. As you probably know, Working Group 1 was published, was approved a month ago in Paris. Some of you are probably there. This is Working Group 2 on impacts, and Working Group 3 is in Bangkok in a month's time. And we've just surfaced from 4 days and last night, and we have approval of our document, and we literally meet in an hour's time with clean copy. They firstly confirmed that on all continents there's a regional signal. Regional climate change is affecting animals, plants, and so on. And secondly, they've concluded that at the global level, this is doing the same. That's an important conclusion, really, because for the first time, we're no longer arm-waving with models. This might happen, right? This is what we call empirical information on the ground. We can measure it. This is the sort of thing that is common around the world, but this is the first time that statistically the case has been proven. 29,000 data sets this group used, and more than 90% of them are in the direction that would be expected for climate change. Here's a Glacier High, just going back, Glacier High in Bolivia. On the left-hand side, 1940, you can see the Skeeto. It was the highest skiing field in the Alps, 1982 on the top right, 1996, and the snow field's gone now. Well, a lot of people were arguing this is, you know, just the regional issue, less snowfall, a precipitation issue, but conclusively now the IPCC, both one last month and two now, has put this into a world story. Thank you. Let me read out some of the things here. Increased water availability in the moist tropics and high latitudes, where it's already moist. We don't want more of it. And unfortunately, decreasing water availability in the second line and drought in the semi-arid low-lying latitudes. It's exactly what we don't want. It makes the world much less even, more inequitable. Ecosystems, up to 30% of species facing extinction with 2 to 3 degrees of warming. Corals, we know they're being bleached now. Widespread coral mortality by about 3 degrees. Can you, by the way, see those numbers? 3 degrees, and can you read coral mortality where I'm pointing? Just have to nod. Okay. Food supply. We knew, but now we know much more, how cereal productivity in low latitudes will tend to decrease, even with a small amount of warming. Starting at 1 degree, you see there's a tendency for a decrease already. For high latitudes, the problem areas in terms of emitters, yields likely to increase, because a little bit of warmth doesn't do them any harm. But there is some point somewhere up here that Easterling and his colleagues, Agrivala, in this room, have found this turns down. There's a key point. Globally, we lost the line because our confidence level is too low. You put these two together, and somewhere around about here, 1 or 2 degrees, you get a global downturn in productivity from climate change. Here are our conclusions about the most vulnerable ecosystem, briefly, headlines. Coral reefs, sea ice regions, those ecosystems that are at the margins, cold tundra and boreal forests, mountain at the high end, and Mediterranean regions, those that are, you know, these ecosystems or communities, and Fischling and Midgley, they're in this room probably as well, have done an incredible job making some up-to-date statements about these things. So that's marginal ecosystems. Secondly, low-lying coasts, again, places at the margin. Water resources in the mid latitudes because of that previous line. Decreases in water resources in dry areas. Low latitude agriculture, because any amount of warming is going to decrease yields there. That's exactly what we don't want, isn't it? We've got 500 million hungry people in the world today, according to the FAO. Those numbers are likely to increase as a result of climate change. And particularly, another vulnerability is human health in those areas where adaptive capacity is low, where there's malnutrition, poorly developed health, public health systems. And the next, corals are one of the issues, particularly affected by ocean temperature. But here's another new point, not reported yet in the IPCC and not yet widely reported in science. We've now begun to realize that increasing levels of CO2 in the atmosphere absorbed into oceans, carbonic, is it, or carbolic acid, one of those two, making for ocean acidification, not the sort of thing that corals want, any shell-forming organism. So an additional impact now, just beginning to be reported in the science literature, are impacts on shell-forming ecosystems, mollusks and so on, in oceans.
Then two reporters point out some of the material that is missing.
Seth Bornstein, Associated Press, for Dr. Perry. In the last 3 or 4 hours of the session, you had at least 3 scientists file official objections that the SPM was underplaying you some of the science. You took out the very high confidence level in the opening bold, the first bold state, bold-faced remark. You took out several parts of the iconic table, SPM 1 and 2. You took out 9 bullet points in terms of the especially affected areas. These are things you mentioned in your speech but aren't going to be in the SPM. You had people like Cynthia Rosenzweig file an official objection. How can you, is there a problem in the whole format when you have scientists objecting to the way government officials are editing their document?
Marlo Hood from Agence France-Presse. I'd like to ask a question about the human impact. It seems to me that's one of the elements that became significantly less specific as the drafts evolved, I think specifically of references to the number of people who will be subject to increased water scarcity and to hunger. Are we to infer from that that it was the judgment that those things are less certain than was thought initially? And a related question, there's very little, if any, reference I could find in even the main report to environmental refugees. And I know that, for example, Ivo de Boer is holding a press conference later today to talk specifically about that issue. How is it that that was not more prominent?
How did you read the full report if it hasn't been up? Doesn't matter. Right.
Professional secret.
Yeah. Right. Just sources. You protect them.
The numbers of human lives to be wrecked is cut down like the casualty figures in Iraq, and an important map of what happens for every degree of climate change was just sliced out. Lack of time, they say. 5 years in preparation, and things are dumped because no one can stay awake any longer in an all-night bargaining session. This is the way humans handle the most important crisis in all of our history? Sheer insanity. Fortunately, with little effort, you can get a good picture of what we can expect with each degree of global warming, from a new book coming out by British author Mark Lynas titled 6 Degrees. Just Google Mark Lynas, spelled L-Y-N-A-S, and listen to our interview with Mark on the Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. And this being the age of internet leaks, you can also download the original PDF report from the scientists before the government hacks got their hands on it. If Google doesn't find it for you, I'll be posting it in the climate section of ecoshock.org by this Sunday. Look for yourself. See what the real science says. Meanwhile, David Wasdell of the Meridian Project is proposing a brand new institution to help us keep updated on global climate science. He was going to call it the New Manhattan Project, but we're not trying to build a weapon of mass destruction, but a weapon of mass salvation. So he's calling it the Apollo Gaia Project instead. You can Google that to find his video on YouTube, but I'll run it for you here now.
Most of us know about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, at least the summary for policymakers of that report that came out at the beginning of February. Now, I was one of the so-called expert reviewers, there's hundreds of us, who had the privilege of looking at the draft of that. In fact, two copies of the draft, 6 months apart. 1,500 pages of text with thousands of references landing on my desk and people saying, please would you report on this within 2 weeks? And I go, Anyway, I'd seen the drafts. And I'd seen the draft of the summary for policymakers. I was astonished at what had been taken out in the final stages of polishing of that document. Just explain what happens. Scientists from all over the world bring together their understanding, argue about what they don't understand, look at the models, and bring together the best possible climate science to understand what is happening to our world system. That goes then through a whole review program and a redrafting program by the scientists. Then in the final stages, intergovernment agents, in other words, agents of all the governments represented in the United Nations, and in the United Nations Environment Programme, who are involved in the Intergovernmental Panel, put their representatives together with some of the scientists to veto what is not acceptable, to weed out stuff that they don't want into the public domain, and the text that comes out is what you think is climate science, is climate science less anything that any government agent wishes to veto or does not wish to see accentuated. Now you can imagine what happens to the science texts when vested interests at national and international level are let loose on attempting to contain information that might damage the national interest or the vested interests of major organisations, industries, or even total income sources to the nation state. So as I analyse the differences between the final report and the second draft, I found that almost all references to accelerated change, to non-linearity, as we call it, where change gets faster and drives increased feedback, have been taken out. References to feedbacks have been taken out. Certainly references to instability and possible threats in the near future had been damped right down. So what we have is a very conservative, very solid foundation of climate change understanding, but one which has taken off the whole of the current understanding of the threat and the problem and the crisis of the global climate that we now face. The denial of climate change has been the most devastating deception ever perpetrated in human history. And it has been driven by massive economic vested interests. Now, all the material on that and the detailed analysis is in my paper that's looking at the processes of the Intergovernmental Panel. And that's available on the website, and I'm sure you can go and look at it for more detail. It's dynamite. It's devastating. And it's been described as one of the most discouraging documents that has ever been seen. What it means is that we, as the human populace who are at risk from climate change, are being hoodwinked into thinking everything's all right and everything's going to be fine when it's far from the case. Some of our leading scientists have been saying the situation is so profoundly disturbing that we now need what they described to start with as a Manhattan Project of climate science, to look at these instabilities, to look at the acceleration, to look at the threat that we now face. Well, Manhattan is not a good name. The Manhattan Project, you will probably remember, had to do with the creating the first atomic bomb. And Manhattan Island isn't a good name in public space at the moment since 9/11 either. So the Manhattan name has been sloughed off. We're using the word Apollo Gaia, the relationship between the Sun and the Earth. And if you want an Apollo association, it's not to putting a man on the moon, it's to Apollo 13 and the mission that almost went into a catastrophe. Our life support system is under threat. The future of our species is under threat. The sustainability of our whole environment is under threat. Planet Earth, we have a problem. The whole of planet Earth is like that capsule in space, with its whole life system under threat. The whole of planet Earth is like the Houston Control Center trying to make it back into a sustainable, viable future. Every single one of us is involved. So watch this space for the Apollo Gaia Project, where the scientists begin to lead policy, where the understanding of the real feedback dynamics make public news, where the motivation to make a difference becomes absolutely imperative, and where we have to mobilize total global effort to get through a crisis which is unprecedented in human history and probably in the history of most life forms that are currently on this planet. Apollo Gaia is the coordinating envelope, if you like, the umbrella project, which will bring to bear the reality of our climate system and mobilize the task ahead. It's going to be tough. Most of us living today will not know whether we succeed in damping runaway climate change. That will take decades to work through, maybe centuries. But if we are successful, then I tell you this, our descendants will look back on this moment where we intervened in the mess we had created and say, that was humanity's finest hour. Thank God they did it.
Frankly, David Wasdell has proposed other giant projects in the past which didn't amount to a lot. I don't see him as the agent which will create an alternative IPCC, especially since only government institutions, so far, have the money to fund all that scientific research and the conferences. But he shows us the real weakness of the IPCC system when it comes to judging our current situation. I'm sure others will call for reform in the process to avoid censorship and the last-minute madness. One final point. Once the third report is released this May, that's it for another 5 years. Come on! New science is popping up practically every week. We're just beginning to understand how the world works. And many top scientists have warned we only have another 5 to 10 years to act, to save our climate as we know it. We can hardly afford to wait another 5 years to get a new report on our situation. Maybe, just maybe, since the planet is threatened with vast changes, most of them quite bad, we could have a full-time staff looking at the science and bringing us updates every month, not every 5 years. When it comes to climate change, the system isn't working, and if we can't change the way we study, report, and act, well, we'll need our Derek Jensen to tell us how to dismantle the industrial economic system before it dismantles life on Earth. The former host of Green Monkey, Zoe Blunt, caught up with Derek here in Vancouver to capture his latest dark thoughts on our future and the activism required to avoid the worst impacts of pollution and climate change. When it comes to deep ecology, Jensen is the philosopher of green despair and resistance. You can find his latest 30-minute interview as a free MP3 download at our website, ecoshock.org. Just choose Greens from our Audio On Demand menu. Personally, I hope it doesn't come to that. Will big governments and big corporations finally act to preserve the rest of the planet? Or will we humans organize in brand new carbon-free ways? Of course, Jensen says such wild hopes are the last remaining barrier, the final stage of denial, before we face our real situation here on the small blue planet. For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith of EcoShock.org.
What do we do when the water is gone? What do we do when the trees are gone? What do we do with this hole in the sky and the pollution in the air? What am I going to do? What am I going to do?
Welcome to the second in a series of four talks recorded earlier this year at the Soil Association Annual Conference. This year's conference was titled One Planet Agriculture and was given over to the challenge that peak oil poses to food security and the imperative for relocalizing food production in order to deal with the twin challenges of climate change and peak oil. Much of today's agriculture relies on fossil fuel-intensive inputs, such as nitrous fertilizers, herbicides and pesticides, as well as the transportation of food huge distances around the globe. The logic and stability of this way of producing our food is seriously brought into question by the likelihood of rising oil prices and the urgent need to cut our emissions of greenhouse gases. A relocalization of food production that uses more traditional methods of small-scale, mixed farming is one possible response to the challenges that we now face. This week's broadcast is dedicated to a talk by another leading light of the peak oil movement, Richard Heinberg. Here he describes the world-changing impact that depleting energy resources will have on agriculture.
He's flown in from California this morning, and I have to let you know in advance that this is that his very presence here is a carbon offset worth having, and whatever footprint it is, he's also got to get back again. But we're extremely grateful for him coming. It's a measure of how committed he is, because he's just been speaking at a conference, the California Eco Farm Organic Conference, yesterday. He is distinguished in America and elsewhere as the author of The Oil Depletion Protocol and The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies. And he, in 2006, was awarded the H. King Hubert Award for Excellence in Energy Education. Richard Heinberg, will you come and educate us?
Thank you so much. Well, I'll have you know that the jet that I flew here on was fueled with biodiesel. Well, I'm going to be talking to you about agriculture and energy. And, of course, food is energy. We human beings are energy junkies, and we always have been. And for most of our existence on this planet, food has been the primary source of our energy, and our primary means of exerting energy into our environment has been muscle power. Now, we have used our big brains over the past few centuries and millennia to find other ways of harnessing energy from our environments, and agriculture actually, in essence, was a strategy for energy capture. Now, as such, it has been subject to the net energy principle. You have to expend energy in order to get energy. The fox has to expend energy chasing down the rabbit in order to get the food energy from eating the rabbit. Now, if the fox has to expend more energy in chasing down rabbits than it gets from eating them, pretty soon no more fox. That's the way it's been with agriculture over centuries of time. In good years, there was a surplus. In bad years, there was famine. But we ran enough of a net energy surplus with agriculture over the centuries in order to be able to build complex societies, civilizations. And without agriculture, that could not have happened. Pre-industrial agriculture was, of course, limited by a number of factors. Soil degradation resulted in the collapse of civilizations repeatedly. And, of course, nitrogen was a limiting factor in that regard. Since the beginning of the fossil fuel age, many of those limits have fallen by the wayside. As we've just seen, the human population has grown dramatically. We achieved 1 billion in 1820, 2 billion in the 1930s, 3 billion in the 1960s, 4 billion in the 70s, 5 billion by the late 1980s, 6 billion by 1999, and we've added another half billion just since 1999. An extraordinary biological success for a species. But, of course, it's a perilous kind of success. And what's that success rested on? Well, replacing draft animals with tractors. Back in 1900, we used to have to set aside about a quarter of our cropland to grow food for horses. That was part of that net energy principle. We were investing energy to get more energy. Now, a horse could do the work of 10 people, so there was a net energy payoff. But now, with tractors, that quarter of our cropland can be devoted to growing more food for more people. Of course, we have hybrid crop varieties, synthetic nitrogen fertilizer made from fossil fuels. We're able to transport food in ever larger quantities, ever further distances, to support populations in places that otherwise would not be able to grow sufficient food for their people. Altogether, we're able to support an enormous and growing human population. But most of the strategies that we've adopted for doing that rely on fossil fuels. Fossil fuels temporarily made the net energy principle virtually irrelevant. Fossil fuels formed millions of years ago, as we heard from Colin, and cooked slowly over time. We are extracting over the course of a mere 10 human generations. And the net energy embodied in fossil fuels is enormous. Perhaps you've had the experience of running out of petrol in your car and having to push it for a couple of meters off the highway. You know that's hard work, pushing an automobile. Well, of course, a single gallon of gasoline can run a car for something like 30 miles, speaking in U.S. terms here. So that's the energy equivalent of something like 6 to 8 weeks of hard human labor in 4 liters of gasoline or petrol. An enormous concentration of energy, and that's what's enabled us to build the industrial world. And the amount of energy that we have to invest to get that energy payoff is trivial. The amount of energy that's required to explore for, drill for oil, compared to the amount of energy that we get back at the end of the day, is relatively trivial. I mentioned natural gas and fertilizer a moment ago. This all comes down to the Haber-Bosch process developed just prior to World War I for creating or synthesizing ammonia from atmospheric nitrogen and the hydrogen in fossil fuels and hydrocarbons. Using the Haber-Bosch process, we're effectively able to double the amount of nitrogen available to the biosphere. Take all of the nitrogen produced from natural sources in a given year, and double that, and that's how much we get from the Haber-Bosch process. And, of course, that doesn't go just into the biosphere generally. We apply it specifically to the crops that we want to grow. Václav Smil at the University of Manitoba regards the Haber-Bosch process as the most important invention of the 20th century because, according to his calculations, something like 3 to 4 billion people would not be alive today if it were not for this process. So, as a result, fertilizer accounts for about 30% of agricultural energy use. But that's not all that we use energy for in agriculture. We use it for powering farm machinery, for powering irrigation pumps, for mechanization of food processing and crop production, maintenance of animal operations, and on and on. Altogether, over 4 barrels of oil are consumed to feed each Briton each year. Now, in the U.S., it's almost twice that amount. So this dependence on oil for agriculture is quite extraordinary. In the U.S., for every calorie of food we produce, we invest 10 calories of fossil fuel energy. Now, think back to the example I gave you a little while ago of the fox pursuing the rabbits. Now, we've created a situation where it's costing us 10 times as much energy as we're able to reap from the process of food production. Clearly, that would be unsupportable, unsustainable, and impossible if it were not for the briefly available, intense source of energy from fossil fuels. We've already heard this morning about the opportunity and challenge of biofuels, and for farmers, this can be, in some ways, an opportunity. Certainly in the U.S., many farmers are going to receive enormous subsidies for growing corn, soybeans, and other biofuel crops. But inevitably, there will be a competition between the food and fuel uses of these crops. Marianne Fisher-Bowell, member of the European Commission responsible for agriculture and rural development, just a few days ago made this statement. She said, "Let's not forget a simple, obvious fact. Some biofuels feedstock competes with food production for available farmland. If this competition became too fierce, our food production could feel the strain, as could those developing countries which are net importers of food." The U.S. is talking about not just producing biofuels in enormous quantities, but importing biofuels. And where are the most effective places to produce biofuels? The tropical regions, because the best biofuels crops to grow are sugarcane and palm oil. And those are best produced in the tropics. So increasingly, we are going to see farmers in tropical regions growing fuel crops rather than growing food for their own people. So in summary, industrial agriculture, which has been an amazing success story in terms of producing enormous quantities of food to feed burgeoning populations, nevertheless leaves society vulnerable because of its heavy dependence on depleting fossil fuels. At the same time, industrial agriculture contributes substantially to global warming. As a result not only of its direct use of fossil fuels, but also because of the release of carbon from soils through the process of tillage. So there are some obvious responses here. Clearly, we need to reduce fossil fuel inputs to agriculture. Secondly, we need to relocalize food systems. Why so? Because we have become dependent on food systems that are globalized. Transporting ever larger quantities of food ever further distances becomes a questionable strategy if fuel prices are escalating. We also need to reduce tillage to preserve carbon in soils, but most of the strategies to reduce tillage that are being adopted around the world entail more intensive use of herbicides, So that has to be avoided because, of course, those herbicides are overwhelmingly made from fossil fuels. There is an opportunity here, which is to begin to see the farm as a source of not only locally produced food for local consumption, but also of locally produced energy for local consumption. And I'm thinking here not just of biofuels, but primarily of other sources of energy, including wind power and solar power. In Cuba, in 1990, there had already been a group of ecological agronomists advising exactly the sort of measures that were in fact required in order for Cuba to survive its energy famine. Those ecological agronomists had been ignored for years. Then when the crisis came, they were called in and allowed to redesign the Cuban food system. I think the Soil Association and other organizations of ecological agronomists and agriculturists around the world are in a similar situation to those Cuban advisors. We have been advising exactly these sorts of measures for years and decades. The removal of fossil fuels from food production, local production for local consumption. Now the crisis is upon us, and that advice needs to be heeded, and very quickly. One of the implications of all of this is the need for great numbers of new farmers. In the Cuban experience, they found that without easy, cheap fossil fuels, they needed much more hand labor. After all, what happened during the 20th century? Millions of farmers left the farm or were driven off the farm because they could not compete with the giant agricultural machinery fed by cheap fossil fuels. And so the farming classes dwindled and the middle classes burgeoned. The order of the day was urbanization throughout the 20th century, and that's a trend still going on. The 21st century will, I think, almost certainly see the opposite trend, the trend of re-ruralization, because we will need lots more people engaged in food production. The Cuban experience was that they found they needed something like 15 to 25% of their population involved in food production, growing food in urban gardens, moving from the cities back to the countryside to work at producing food. If that same percentage holds for other industrialized nations, then extrapolated to the UK, we're talking about something like a minimum of 10 million new farmers needed over the next 20 to 30 years. That's an extraordinary cultural shift to take place in this country, in North America, and many other countries. I believe it will happen whether we plan for it or not. If we don't plan for it, we will see people fleeing cities to the countryside, hoping to grow some food for themselves. And they will fail miserably, because, as I'm sure many people in this room realize, it actually takes some skill to grow food. If we plan for the process, I think we could see a cultural renaissance throughout the world. Urbanization has carried an enormous cultural and social cost, including the death of many rural communities, certainly in North America. I'm very familiar with the story there, having grown up in Missouri in the Midwest and seeing that part of the country become a cultural wasteland over the past 50 years. Exactly the opposite trend needs to occur over the next 20 or 30 years. We need to revivify the culture of rural communities so that these places become attractive to people who wish to farm. Now, we have examples not just in Cuba, but also in North America and Britain. During World Wars I and II, we saw Victory Garden movement. I'm not sure what the story was here. I'm more familiar with the situation in North America. There, these movements were a genuine social movement. In fact, the U.S. Department of Agriculture tried to discourage the Victory Farm movements in both world wars because they were concerned that they would get in the way of industrializing agriculture. During World War II, Eleanor Roosevelt decided to grow a victory garden on the White House lawn, and that sort of changed the course of things. The U.S. Department of Agriculture then decided that victory gardens were a good idea, and they then took credit for them and started to promote them. Well, the point of my bringing this up is that during World War II, the U.S. grew something like 40% of its vegetables and fruits in backyard gardens. So this is a success story that can be repeated. But policies are going to be required, ultimately, in order to assist in this process of cultural transition, of re-ruralization, of re-localization of economies and food production. Policies like land reform, of education for farmers, of loans and other financial incentives. We need higher and stabilized food prices, just as we need high and stabilized energy prices, in order to give the proper price signals for organizations and companies and individuals to respond. One positive example I can point to is that of Oakland, California, which has made the goal of growing 30% of the city's food within 50 miles of city limits by 2020. That city has also made the goal of becoming petroleum-free by 2020. We'll see how it does. I've been asked to be on the mayor's task force to design the strategy for accomplishing this. Quite frankly, I'm not sure how we're going to do it, but I know that we have to set robust goals of this nature and use all of our creativity and effort in order to achieve them. One suggestion I would leave you with is the possibility of the Soil Association conspiring with other similar organizations elsewhere in the world. This last Wednesday evening, I was speaking with the Ecological Agriculture Association of North America on the same topic. A few weeks ago, speaking to the Canadian National Farmers Union and others. I can assure you that there many other organizations have exactly similar concerns right now about the impact of future energy shortages on food production, about the need to educate and support millions of new farmers. This is an enormous task. It's going to require more than just one organization working at it, and it's a task that will have to be addressed in many nations around the world. So this is just a suggestion that some form of coalition be created to very vigorously pursue the policies that will enable this to happen. So finally, just to summarize, if the 20th century was about moving people off the farms into the cities, if it was about depending more and more on limited but powerful fossil fuels to replace human labor and food production and to move food ever further distances, the 21st century is going to be just the opposite. It's going to be about the relocalization of food production. It's going to be about declining oil and gas availability, the declining availability of chemical fertilizers. It's going to be about the increasing need for human labor inputs and the need for more food producers as a percentage of the population. This century is the century of the great energy transition, the transition away from fossil fuels to what? Well, we don't know exactly. Certainly, the bulk of the transition is going to be a matter of simply doing with less energy and making up for the gap wherever we can using renewable sources of energy. It's going to be an enormous challenge for every segment of society and for every society. But the longer we wait, the greater that challenge will be. Thank you very much.
That was Richard Heinberg, author of a number of books addressing the impact of peak oil, speaking at the Soil Association Annual Conference on 26th January 2007. A transcript of the text, along with Richard's slideshow, is available on the Soil Association's website, www.soilassociation.org. And our thanks go out to the Soil Association for giving their permission to broadcast this talk. This program was produced by Climate Radio for Resonance 104.4 FM in London and rebroadcast by a number of community radio stations around the UK.
This neighborhood is blighted, that's what people say. Half the buildings are abandoned, everything is grey. Half the kids have eyes because of the sewage plants nearby. And the mayor doesn't seem to care if we live or die. That's the situation. Now let me take you to the part, the center of this neighborhood, what you could call the heart of a vacant lot of broken glass. For years that's what it's been, but the neighbors got together, said this is where we will begin. We'll dig this dirt, plant a seed, push aside the concrete so the earth beneath is free. We'll plant a garden, grow some food to eat, and the sunflowers look into the sky say we reclaim this street. One day we had accomplished what the mayor always said. He was trying to bring us, threw his clubs upon our heads. The neighborhood is clean, the dealer's gone away. We had good food to eat, place for the kids to play. We'll dig this dirt, plant a seed, push aside the concrete so the earth beneath is free. We'll plant a garden, grow some food to eat, and the sunflowers look into the sky say we reclaim this street. Twice the city came here, said this is not our land. Twice the cops destroyed it, all the work of our own hands. Uprooted plants and broken tools lay scattered all around. But the next day the only thing you could see was fingers in the ground. We'll dig this dirt, plant a seed, push aside the concrete so the earth beneath is free. We'll plant a garden, grow some food to eat, and the sunflowers look into the sky say we reclaim this street. We reclaim this street.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren.
Okay, now it's my pleasure to introduce to you the author of The Freedom and war journalist for The Nation magazine, Dr. Christian Parenti.
Hello. Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming out once again, and thanks for inviting me. I was here a year and a half ago, and some of what I'm going to say tonight is going to cover the same terrain because the problem has not changed fundamentally. We're still at war in Iraq. But as the situation there gets worse and worse, I think that we're entering a moment of interesting political convergence where, despite many differences that people on the left and the right might have around certain questions, that the failure of the policy in Iraq is becoming so clear that a certain simple but pressing question is presenting itself, which is how are we going to get out of Iraq? Because I don't think that it's within the realm of reasonable possibilities that the U.S. can win. And I guess I'll begin my my comments there, and then eventually move on to some questions around trying to figure out why this war happened, why we can't get out of it, to whose benefit is all of this working. So I haven't actually been to Iraq since 2005, the autumn of 2005, because it's gotten so violent there that it's impossible for journalists from magazines such as The Nation, which, though it's the oldest weekly in the U.S., doesn't have a huge budget. And so now the journalists that you see on TV, for the most part, not for the most part, all of them live in militarily fortified hotels. They travel in armored vehicles, and they have armed security. That requires an enormous budget. And journalists are also very restricted in their movement, even under those conditions. They definitely get out and about, but a lot of the reporting is done by Iraqi translators and fixers who are now operating as essentially stringers who go out and do the interviews, and then the journalists who conceive the story and meld all this together write it up. I mean, similar to, you know, the way a lot of reporting is done is in large cities. You don't travel down to the office of so-and-so. You call them up on the phone. So you don't necessarily have to be in physical contact with people to interview them or to have somebody interview them for you in Arabic. But I have been to Afghanistan several times, twice this year, and that, unfortunately, that situation is also disintegrating. So maybe the best place to start is to just give you my sense of what's going on in Iraq now. I mean, there was a debate a while ago about whether or not we should call this a civil war, and the Bush administration was adamantly opposed to the idea of using that term, because I think the subtext of that debate was that if it was acknowledged that there was a civil war, that would also essentially acknowledge a situation in which the U.S. military was incapable of bringing the violence to an end. It's gotten to the point where I think even calling the violence in Iraq a civil war is almost a polite obfuscation of something much more complex. I mean, the basic divisions in Iraq, as you well know, are between the Kurds in the north and the Arabs in the south. The Kurds make up about 15 to 20% of the population, the Arabs the rest of the population. The Arab south is divided between Sunnis and Shia, two sects of Islam. The Sunni Arabs of Iraq have been the ruling group since the Ottoman Empire, when Iraq was not a nation, but it was made up of three vilayets, or provinces, of the Ottoman Empire. And it was at the end of World War I that the Ottomans, who sided with Germany, were defeated. Turkey, the country of Turkey, is what remains of the Ottoman Empire. These three vilayets were cobbled together by the British and became the state Iraq. And since the U.S. invasion, the Sunni minority, about 20% of the population, which ran the country under the Ottomans and under the British and then under independence and dominated the Ba'ath Party, are now out of power and are the heart of the Sunni resistance. And they're facing off with the Shiites and had under Saddam fought the Kurds. That's pretty complex in and of itself. But it gets even worse than that. Within the Shia government and sector of the population, there are three main parties, but there are actually many more. The three main parties are the Dawah Party, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and Muqtada Sadr's party, which has a complicated name that people rarely use. They just usually refer to it as the Mahdi Army. So these three parties dominate the government because there were elections in 2005, which were not originally part of the U.S. plan in Iraq. The U.S. was trying to prevent elections. L. Paul Bremer, the man who was in charge of administering the occupation for the better part of the first year, denied that elections could happen. And he said that there needed to be a complicated census and planning, and in the interim, there would have to be an appointed government. But it was the Shia who demanded that there would be an election. They make up 60% of the population. And surprise, surprise, what happened when there was a real election? They won. And they now control the government. And the reason that Paul Bremer and the representative of the Bush administration in Iraq didn't want there to be elections was because these three main Shiite parties spent most of Saddam's regime in exile in Iran and were given support and aid by the Iranian state, which is a Shiite theocracy. So the parties that have come to power in Iraq under this U.S. occupation benefit in many ways from the U.S. occupation, but are ultimately loyal to Iran and have much deeper ties to Iran. And some of them have come right out and said that if the U.S. attacks Iran, they will fight for Iran. Muqtada Sadr has said that. But so these three parties, they don't even quite make up a unified front, even though they share the government. The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution had in Iraq, the Skiri, has a militia called the Badr Brigades. The Badr Brigades routinely fight with the Mahdi army, Muqtada Sadr's followers. In the south, they've had pitched battles. There's routine assassinations and jockeying for control of different areas and ministries in Iraq. So this, what I'm trying to do here is layer on levels of complexity so that you get a sense of how deep this crisis is in Iraq. Then even within these organizations, they're not necessarily as coherent as you would think. Sadr's organization, Muqtada Sadr is the son of a famous and charismatic Shiite cleric who was assassinated by Saddam Hussein. He's revered as a martyr. His son, Muqtada Sadr, who's in his early mid-30s, has risen to power, and he's very articulate, very nationalist, very popular, powerful politician in Iraq. But it's become clear that he doesn't even actually control his organization. He has again and again tried to rein in his forces, and they have disobeyed, and they continue attacking U.S. soldiers or engaging in sectarian violence against Sunni populations or fighting over turf and loot with their rival Shia parties. And I was witness to the beginning of some of this breakdown last time I was in Sadr City when the 1st Cavalry was there. It was the summer of 2004, and they were fighting these on-again, off-again fights with the Mahdi army. And finally, Sadr called a ceasefire, and I interviewed a cell of his fighters who were basically religious students who wanted to overthrow Saddam and have a religious government. They didn't like the fact that Saddam wasn't Shiite, one, and that it wasn't a theocracy in Iraq. And so they were jailed under Saddam and tortured in Abu Ghraib. And one of them was actually, before he was jailed in Abu Ghraib, he knew the police were after him. And one of the top hackers in Iraq was this young Shia guy who actually had polio and was very brilliant guy with computers, managed to get this guy and 23 other of these Sadrist activists out of Iraq. But then this guy came back to get his family, and he was arrested by Saddam Hussein, thrown in Abu Ghraib, tortured. And then Saddam empties Abu Ghraib in October 2002, and this guy goes during the occupation and joins up with Muqtada Sadr. So Sadr gives this cell of the Jeshi-Mehdi the general orders of enough of this fight. You know, we can't really go toe-to-toe with the 1st Cavalry, so enough is enough. And these guys, because I met them through this hacker, this computer genius who had basically saved their lives once upon a time, they trusted me, and they figured I wasn't that I was a journalist, I wasn't actually some sort of CIA agent who was going to arrest them. And they showed me an IED, and they said, "Yeah, we're going to use this." And I said, "Well, what, you know, Sadr has called off your offensive, hasn't he?" And they said, "Yeah, we're not going to do anything in Sadr City, but you know, we'll go out into Sunni areas and we'll attack Americans." And you know, that way it won't look like we're doing it. So that was, you know, one small example of how Sadr was sort of losing control of his forces. So, and there's, you know, at various levels, regional commanders loyal to Sadr who pursue their own private wars. The country is in such deep chaos. There's so much crime. Communication has broken down. The roads are so violent that even what would seem to be one of the most powerful organizations within Iraq is itself fragmenting. So, likewise, you go to Kurdistan. You think, well, this is a simple piece of the puzzle, right? The Kurds have been oppressed by the Arabs, and they want their independence, and they basically probably already have it. And the first thing I learned when I got to Kurdistan was that actually Kurdistan is itself bitterly divided, and that the main rivalry you hear about in Kurdistan is less their rivalry with Arabs and more the rivalry between the two Kurdish parties, the PUK and the PDK. The PUK broke away from the PDK about 20 years ago, or more than 25 years ago.